from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. This is April, which means National Poetry Month. And while I like to encourage listeners to explore poetry all year round, I'm partial to April and its celebration of the form. This is from the website poets.org. National Poetry Month was inaugurated by the Academy of American Poets in 1996. Over the years, it has become the largest literary celebration in the world, with schools, publishers, libraries, booksellers, and poets celebrating poetry's vital place in our culture. So today on Write the Book, you'll hear two conversations with poets. First, a new interview with Vermont poet Ralph Culver, who is live with me here in the studio. And then in the second half of the show, I'll play an interview from the archives with the poet Charles Harper Webb. So, Ralph, I'm going to read your bio, and then we're going to dig right in. So, Ralph Culver was born in Champaign, Illinois, and grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Since the 1970s, apart from a year or so spent in New York City, he has lived in Vermont. He studied creative writing and literature at Goddard College, the New School, and the MFA program for writers at Warren Wilson College. His poetry, fiction, and criticism have appeared in numerous publications, and he is a past grantee in poetry of the Vermont Arts Council and multiple nominee for the Pushcart Prize. Culver's first poetry collection, Both Distances, won the 2012 Anabiosis Press Chapbook Prize. And then his second, So Be It, was published in 2018, which is what we're going to spend some time talking about today. His poems have been anthologized and reprinted in print and online, and he is a popular lecturer and reader of his work, having given many poetry readings in public spaces over the years. So I spoke to Ralph once before on this show in 2013. So welcome back to Write the Book, Ralph. How are you doing?
Thank you, Shayla. It's a delightful experience for me to be back.
Yeah, it's great to have
it's
you.
Good to meet you in person. We did the last one on the phone.
On the phone. It's true. It's true. it's great. And I really enjoyed reading So Be It, your new chapbook of poems, a beautiful collection. So let's start by talking a little bit about how this chapbook came together for you. How did you decide to pull these poems together into So Be It?
Well, the chapbook's divided into three sections, and when I was thinking about compiling poems to publish them together again, I decided that because a lot of my work falls into thematic categories, that it would be interesting to break the book up into thematic sections.
Uh-huh.
So the three sections of the collection are, the first is called Boy at the Plate, and those, for the most part, are poems about childhood or sort of an assessment of childhood experiences.
Right.
The middle section is called Last Call, which has to do with more adult concerns. And the final section, So Be It, is more of a sort of an overview, or uh-huh. sort of experiential overview
okay.
of things.
Now, I'm curious, just generally speaking, apart from this chapbook, in writing a poem, what is it that you look to accomplish or discover or do when you sit down to write a poem? Is it you're just sort of responding to the impulse to write, or are you usually setting out to accomplish something specific?
I think it happens a lot of different ways, and certainly there are occasions where I'm looking specifically to accomplish sort of a goal that I've set in
mm-hmm.
mind.
Okay.
There's a particular event that I want to work with. There's a particular emotion that I want to work with.
Right.
And then there are other situations where I could be driving along in the car, or I could be singing in the shower, and a line will just pop into my head, and I have no idea really where, you know, what the gestation of that is, where it comes from.
Right.
But I recognize it almost immediately for what it is, which is some little kernel of inspiration, and then I'll just kind of allow it to take me wherever it is I need to go to
to get to the place to find a home for that thing that just pops into my head.
Does it stay there, or do you have to pull the car over and quickly like write it down?
Sometimes I'll jot it down, even if it's like on the back of my hand or something like that.
Right.
If I don't have any paper available. Yeah, sometimes I have to write it down.
Yeah.
Waking up in the middle of the night after having a dream or something. If I don't write those things down, if I think they're going to be useful, I know within an hour or two, I'll have forgotten.
And that's so frustrating, isn't it? Oh, wait a minute, I know that was going to be brilliant. What happened? Well, so Ralph, I wonder if we can take a look at some of the poems in So Be It.
Sure.
And what I was going to ask is if you could just read a poem at a time, and then we can talk about each of them. And
okay.
I'm sort of just going right through the collection.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering if you could start with the first poem, Taking Bluegill at Lake Seneca.
I would be glad to.
Okay, great.
Taking Bluegill at Lake Seneca for my sister and cousins. Under the weight of a few rocks and the unmerciful heat of midday, they lie. Eight bejeweled beauties aligned on the edge of the dock, the first five utterly still, the two next murmuring at the gills, and the last not quite reduced to commentary, but yet in the veil of acts and action. A tremor shudders his length to the tail, the caudal fin taut and quaking, and I suddenly feel a memory fall through me of what it meant to consider surrender. Remembering swimming for shore on a dare, our rowboat out too far and the sound of thunder nearing. A limitless pain and fear deep in my thighs and calves, so pathologically engraved there, I stare down at my bare legs in wonder and laugh. But I am young, and so these fish are young, this water with its battered skin is young, the trees surrounding young. Even my father and mother are young. Soon the eighth captive is left no belief in escape, but speaks instead his conviction of infinite release. I will not be the one to flay them naked or scuttle the flawless heads in the minnow bucket for the coons. I will not touch them again except to eat them. So speech is mine. The first words are small and have a taste of hook. The sting of a pearl of wine.
Thank you for reading that.
Sure.
I really enjoyed reading that poem. I read it over several times, and I think it's funny that there's a rhyme scheme in this poem, but it's not. I don't know. It didn't strike me until I had read it a couple times. You know. So we've got rocks and dock, still and gills. I'm trying to remember, veil, tail. Anyway, is this a known poetic form, or are you kind of riffing as you go? I don't know this one, but
it's not a formal form.
Right.
It's more a construction where I'm hoping that the outcome is going to show that I've paid close attention to sound. And that there's sort of a musical and rhythmic element to the poem that comes through.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And then there's that line, so speech is mine, and the people listening to the show haven't been able to look at the page, but that is the only line that stands out from the margin on the page, and it really draws attention to itself, speech is mine. Mm-hmm. Talk about deciding to do that.
Well, if as you pointed out, it's difficult for people listening to see really how the poem's laid out, but that line is indented only so far as it would have occurred after the word them in the line above.
Right.
So what I was trying to do there was graphically depict that there's a sense of a break, not quite stanzaic. There's not like an extra line space in the poem there. But there's a kind of a continuation from the previous line, except to eat them. While at the same time it being a little bit, there's a turn there that has to happen for the reader to suddenly come sort of into the narrator and the present for that narrator who's looking back at these at these memories, at these recollections.
Right, right. So something you just said made me think of a question that comes up often for me with poetry, actually with prose too, but especially maybe with poetry. And that is, to what extent are you writing for yourself as a reader or thinking of other readers who perhaps don't know the stories that feed the memories that feed the poem, you know?
Marianne Moore famously said, "It's something I should." This is a line of hers that I've sort of tried to live by in terms of my own dedication to this work. And Marianne Moore said, "A writer who is overwhelmingly honest in pleasing himself is almost certain to please others." The tricky part there is overwhelmingly honest.
Yeah, it's the honesty.
That's where it gets dicey.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not just the pleasing yourself, because you can write stuff that you think is just brilliant.
Right. And where poetry is concerned, I can be pretty OCD, pretty fastidious, and pretty demanding of myself. And so overwhelmingly honest is really the key to that. If I'm going to be overwhelmingly honest in pleasing myself and feel some assurance that that's going to please others, then that's what I really have to work toward. I have to be overwhelmingly honest with myself and with the work.
That's a great piece of advice from her.
That's a great line.
Okay. So I think the very next poem is called Fill Up.
Yes.
And I really was very moved by this, and I wonder if you could read that one for us.
I'd be happy to. Fill Up. Lulled, he sits, a nothing in the vast back seat. Amid the drumming of the gasoline, the stunned smell of worn felt and Marlboros. Two heedless growths perch on their collared stems, murmur the day and will not turn. Between them, the air bends out above the hood, the way a snake sends itself across the surface of a lake. He studies his debased reflection in the chrome plate of an ashtray, mounted damaged at the center of his parents' seat before him. Gulf. He slowly leans into that face. It swells, narrows, and runs down the cracked silver. One voice enlarges, saying, "Watch it, honey, or you're going to be replaced." A laugh, a cough. They are always almost there. Where are they taking him? How could I, waiting for whatever was to happen, how could I not see where they were taking him?
Thank you again. Let's talk first about the he and the I in that poem.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
The shared changing narrative, which I suspect has to do with the speaker's age or retrospective perspective.
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I was talking with a very dear friend of mine about just in the last day or so about the narrative change in this poem, going from third person to first person.
Yeah,
and I think it's in the third from the last line, and I it's a little bit tricky, I think, to pull that off, and I hope that the poem does that. But for the reader, I like to think that there's a sudden realization there at that point that, oh, this really is sort of a coldly autobiographical poem, that to go from that third-person narrative to suddenly turning it on a dime to first-person, and yet even referring to even the narrator even referring to himself in the third-person after the I is brought out. Is a sudden sort of hit, maybe, you know, not in the solar plexus, maybe it's not that rough, but hopefully it's an indication that this is really a sort of a closely observed circumstance of a child that is in fact the narrator himself.
Yeah. And I have a few different things that I thought. I felt like it was a little bit self-protective to do it in the third person. Mm-hmm. It allows a certain distance that also keeps the eye from having to identify with this other fairly bleak story, bleak moment in time. The vocabulary is so perfect. You know, it indicates dislocation and state of mind. Just the words lulled, nothing, stunned, heedless, debased. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think as children, we all have these memories of feeling a little bit ignored or a little bit dislocated, mm-hmm. and that's good too, because then we can relate.
Estranged.
And being
a word I really like.
Yeah, being transported too. Like you're being taken places, and you don't really have anything to say about it. They were always almost there. That was so perfect. Mm. But the other thing that happens right after the narrative changes from third person to first person is this wonderful turn of phrase, waiting for whatever was to happen to happen. And that gave us a moment to think about something else, too. You know, it was nice. Mm. You know, it wasn't just like waiting for whatever was going to happen. Mm-hmm. I loved that.
Mm. Thanks.
Yeah. And then the other thing that I really enjoyed in this poem is that ashtray. It's the reflection. Writing about a reflection is an interesting thing. I was actually thinking that if we didn't use other prompts today, we could tell people to write about a reflection or, you know, include a reflection in your... And then there's also the cough. Now, I had this sense of the parents are no longer with the first person narrator, although they are almost all, almost there. Sounds like the car ride, but it also sort of feels like the parents are always there.
Almost there.
Almost.
Yes. Right.
And
that's correct.
Anyway, it's just a really interesting poem. I got so much out of reading
that. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah. So now I wanted to know if, and perhaps we've already touched on one that you might have been going to mention, but I wondered if there's a certain poem in this collection that you found particularly hard to write, or maybe there are several, and then if any of them came much more easily.
Sure. It's a great question, actually, and it does sort of, it fits nicely with what we were just talking about, because... that word hard there's so much nuance in it.
Right.
I mean, there are different reasons why a piece of writing can be hard to write.
I mean,
sometimes it's hard to, you know, like, are we asking if it's simply the difficulty in kind of bringing it in, you know, on time and in one piece? Or is it the emotional material that you're trying to deal with that might be particularly difficult? So, in terms of difficult to get right, I would say Taking Bluegills at Lake Seneca is a good example of one in this collection that it took me a really long time before I could get it to, going back to Marianne Moore's, you know, dictum,
the honesty.
Being overwhelmingly honest. I just simply could not get happy with the middle section, especially. And then... what happened was I came upon the trope sort of putting in there the anecdote about the boy is swimming for shore, but the boat is out too far, and the sort of threatening sound of thunder, you know, in the distance of a storm coming on, with the making that sort of movement from the observation of the dead and dying fish that the boy has pulled out of the lake to his own, you know, consideration of surrender, which gets embodied in the anecdote about swimming for shore, and the, you know, and it's really there. He realizes in the water, I'm too far out.
Right. There's like a deep pain and fear.
Yeah. But until I hit upon that. That approach to the poem, that whole middle section was just completely lost for me. And I knew how I wanted it to end. But I just didn't know how to get there.
Yeah.
I had a beginning and I had an end, but I didn't have a middle.
You must have ended up very pleased with it to put it first in the chapbook.
I'm happy with the poem, yes. But yeah. Also, in terms of the construction of the chapbook, I wanted, because of this childhood section at the beginning, I wanted a poem that really sort of closely looked at an early part of childhood. Mm-hmm. I mean, this child is probably only about 7 or 8 years old, mm-hmm. or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then there were other poems in the book that were hard to do in a different sort of sense. One is in the second section, "Dancing Down Broadway with My Bottle of Brandy."
Oh yeah,
that poem. I had the outline of that poem, sort of the original shape that it was going to take, over 40 years ago, like in the 1970s.
Oh, wow.
And never, I worked on it for ages until I finally, probably 10 years ago, finally figured out, or finally, determined that it was done. And then as far as easy goes, I'd say the easiest one in the book is the one prose poem in the collection, which is called Tableau.
Oh, yeah.
Which is also in the second section. And I would say that what you read right there is exactly as I wrote it, with one major exception. I started out with what is the middle paragraph as the first paragraph. And then when it was done, I realized that that was just an offense to my logic of both visually and sort of emotionally how you would want to look at this tableau.
Do you want to read that one?
Yeah, sure. We can do that.
Yeah, let's do that because
Yeah.
We already read the one that was most difficult, or perhaps, and let's read this one too.
Tableau. A boy lies on his stomach on the floor, head propped up on his left hand, drawing on a sketchbook with his right. So far, only a line or two, just a suggestion of a shape. Over near the window, sitting at his desk, a man stares at a sheet of paper rolled into a typewriter. A few words are there, nothing substantial. And the third figure in the room, whose very form is nascent, untroubled by detail, nearly transparent, really. Although the man and the boy sense a presence, acknowledge it, they pay it no mind, confident as they are, as you are reading this, as I am writing it, that now is not the time. The figure congeals, casting a shadow at last, and rises to take his measure.
Hmm. That's great.
So that poem pretty much came out exactly as you see it here. But again, with the first and the second sections, the man sitting at his desk with the sheet of paper and the typewriter was the first part that I wrote originally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I realized there was just something that was wrong about that it was more logical to go from an age perspective, from child to man.
Because again,
but also looking from a visual perspective, sort of looking at the child on the floor and then your eyes coming up
right.
to the man sitting at the desk too.
Yeah, yeah. And we've once again got sort of perhaps the same person in the poem, even though there's a boy and a man. Is that, yeah?
Yeah.
That's
yes.
intended, yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about publishing this collection, mm-hmm. this chapbook, So Be It. So Wolfgang Press.
Mm-hmm. That's me.
That's you.
Right.
So what was the process that you took to put this out?
I have some friends, poets themselves, who, I'm happy to say are just enjoy the work that I do.
Yep.
And they have been on my both Distances, which was my first collection, which you and I talked about
right.
five years ago.
Right.
That enough time sort of had gone by where people were on my case to put something more out there. I mean, the poems had all been published in magazines and journals.
Right.
But to sort of get them between covers and do a collection
yeah.
while I'm lobbying publishers you know, here and there to try to get a full-length collection put together, that, you know, I was getting a lot of urging from different people to, you know, you really need to put some of this stuff out there so that other people can read it and enjoy it. So
yeah, nice.
So I just, 5 years had passed since both distances, and I thought this would be a good time to put another chapbook together.
And did you go to a local printer, or did you use a source online?
I'm happy to... The printer was an outfit in San Francisco, that a dear friend of mine going all the way back to junior high school works for. Well, he's actually... This chapbook was the last job he took on before he retired.
Oh, so, wow. That's nice.
But he was really happy to... Yeah, he thought it was great that was the last thing that he... The last official professional thing that he did at this place he had worked at for many, many years. So they did the printing. I did... I chose the... fortunately for me, I have some skills in that department. So I did the layout and design of the chapbook, designed the cover.
Nice. Yeah.
Chose the typefaces and did the typesetting myself.
Okay, so. Great. Are you happy with how it went?
Very happy.
Would you do it again?
Would I do it again? Boy. Well, I mean, I certainly saved myself some money by not hiring a professional designer.
But, oh, I mean the whole thing.
Oh, would I do it again?
Yeah.
Oh, the whole thing again? Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely.
Great. Okay, let's read another one. There's one in here called Last Call.
Okay.
And that's in the second section, I believe.
Yes, the namesake poem of that section, which is that
right.
section of the book is Last Call.
Oh, yeah, that's
sure.
True.
Okay, Last Call. What the mind fashions, what the mind does not, she says, but no way I'm being sucked into that dialectic. A freezing wind follows someone through the door and claws its way up the inside of my pant legs, finishing the job that her voice had begun an hour before of dismantling my sense of ease and rightness in the evening. The bar is half empty. This was long enough ago that you could still smoke while sitting at your table. And I light one as she slowly drains another shot of ouzo, the achingly deliberate rolling of her wrist, then the equally precise wiping of the back of the other wrist across her mouth. In fact, this was long enough ago that I had already stopped drinking, or better, that drinking had clubbed me into abstinence. And I suddenly vividly recall a night in the same bar, a more distant time and woman sitting there across from me, when in disgust I had watched myself strain to complete a sentence with a full 10 seconds plodding by between each sodden word I spoke. She beckons to the waitress, coral smeared across her knuckles. And now, she says, the mind fashions that you will drive me home, and the mind does not fashion that you will sleep with me. If this be youth with its glory passing into shade, I think, give thanks, its dissolution overdue. She reaches for my cigarette and knocks the empty shot glass over.
That's great. As I read this, I realized that we see a lot of work about addiction, I think, mm-hmm. from a first person perspective. I don't think I've seen that many pieces of work that are from the perspective of somebody who has given up their addiction and is observing somebody else suffering from it. Do you know what I mean? And I liked that about this. I liked his watching this woman and being able to have all of these realizations about his own path.
Yeah. And that's a touchy thing for some people. I was having dinner with my girlfriend the other night, and she asked me, she said, "Do you mind if I order a glass of wine?" And I looked at her and I said, you know, when I gave this up because I knew I had to, I also knew I was going to have to live in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you just don't walk away from everything just because you give up one thing. And that means you have to be perfectly open and tolerant of other people enjoying the thing that you can't enjoy.
So. Right, yeah. Although this person in Last Call, I think beyond enjoying it, she's suffering from a problem, it sounds like,
yeah.
Right? I loved that her knuckles are coral smeared, and there's no specific explanation that that's her lipstick from having wiped her mouth before, but I really liked that you just let us recognize that. That was great. Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm going to just pause now and say you're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, 99.3 FM, and streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, and I am speaking with Vermont poet Ralph Culver. If you're enjoying the show, I would encourage you to please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and help us spread the word. Okay, great. So one of my favorites in here, and that's because, of course, we all like recognizing things that we are familiar with, is First Night Perkins Pier.
Oh, okay, sure.
Would you mind reading that one?
I would be happy to.
I also like that it's an acrostic, and I didn't know that until I got to your note at the end, and I went back and read it again, and I thought we could talk about what an acrostic is after
you're
finished.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. First Night Perkins Pier. Here, a woman draws a white coat close against the cold. The sky presents its chalice. Please dissolve in smoke at the lips of young children refusing to come in. Nothing will change. Each day plays the songs of water, of bread, of dying. Yet the winter lasts only a moment, edging the lake ice. A girl tests her new skates, ringing a silver bell, eating a coin of chocolate.
Love that. Thank you very much.
Sure.
So the first letters of each line spell a kind of secret hidden message.
Right.
Which is what an acrostic
That's
is.
That's what an acrostic is.
Yeah. So why don't you go ahead and tell us what it spells.
For listeners who are local, of course, I think they would all recognize Perkins Pier, where that is in Burlington. And of course, the city of Burlington has a long first night tradition. So for anyone who's aware of First Night in Perkins Pier, they would maybe get a hint of what's going on here. But the first letter of each line in the poem spells out the three-word phrase, Happy New Year.
Right, in three stanzas, which is great. And First Night, of course, being New Year's Eve.
Right.
Celebrated in a family-friendly way.
Right.
And in downtown. It's fantastic. I love that one. And also, I wanted to just talk a little bit about story in poems.
Sure.
Because I think you do quite a lot of that. You include stories in your poems. I mean, not that you tell a, you know, once upon a time kind of story, but we see things sort of unfold on the page,
right.
And they tend to have a bit of a story arc as well.
Mm-hmm.
This one's pretty small, you know, little story, but I love it. And I love the imagery, the silver bell, the coin of chocolate. But can you talk a little bit about including stories in poems?
Yeah, sure. In poetry, in its, you know, thousands of years of existence, narrative probably was the driving force of poetry for many hundreds, certainly many centuries. And, you know, I think of the English romantics, for example, like, you know, Keats and Byron and Shelley, Coleridge. Well, there's a lot of narrative in Coleridge. And of course, even those three, there are certain poems that have very exhaustive sort of narratives. But the notion of the sort of personal lyric poem that isn't so much concerned with narrative as it is the embodiment or expression of an emotion or an idea or something like that. If in fact those are sort of broadly two different kinds of poetry, I don't really like the idea of them kind of facing off,
right.
You know, and duking it out, you know, for attention or something like that. I think that there's a very natural inclination for readers to be able to kind of be caught up in or to follow, even in First Night Perkins Pier, as you pointed out, it's not that that's a story so much, but it's kind of a vignette.
Right, exactly.
And there are sort of narrative elements where you can kind of pick up on that something going on.
Right. Yeah. But
I like the idea that, narrative, first of all, is engaging. Mm-hmm. It helps people sort of hook into something, you know, because that's historically what stories have always done.
Right.
I mean, they really, sitting around a campfire, you know, nothing more fun, right, than telling yarns, you know, smoking cigarettes and telling lies. So it's always fun for me when I'm working on something to try to give it a shape,
yes,
where there are, maybe... If it's not like, it doesn't have to be a story with a beginning, middle, and end, but at least it has narrative elements that a reader can follow and that can help sort of engage them in what's going on.
Right, right. And actually, I think The First Night Perkins Pier probably isn't one of the ones that has more story, mm-hmm. some of the other, like certainly that, the bluegills, I think, as you mentioned, the taking bluegill at Lake Seneca, there's a story within a story even, mm-hmm. because you've got the kids swimming and the fish being caught.
And probably, I don't know, I mean, if Bargainers is a poem that it really is sort of a short story.
Yeah, and I actually was going to ask you to read that one. Do you want to read that one now?
Do you want to do that one now?
Yeah,
if you like.
Okay. Another one, yeah.
Yeah, and there are a couple of things I guess I would say about the poem afterward, too, that, let's read the poem first. Okay, Bargainers, for Louise Glick. In the market... Saturday, the world's commerce on the simplest terms anyone can understand. Hanks of dried chilies like garlands of tongues, baskets of Roma tomatoes in the noon sun, warm and firm to the touch. A young man leans against the stone facade of the pastry shop under the shade of a window awning. He's trying to catch the eye of the girl selling the tomatoes, while an old couple haggles with her about the price and when the tomatoes were picked. The young man lights a thin cigar. It's black and slightly bent, as though he were setting fire to an oak twig in his mouth. He shakes out the match and snaps it into the street in one movement, a gesture he had seen in a film as a child and never forgotten. Some actor in a narrow tie and lapels and steel-framed sunglasses. A doomed hero. Not too bright, really. Although this hadn't mattered in the least. Sheer determination and purpose, that was what counted. The details of the story, the movie's title, a movie as old as the young man's parents, maybe older, all that's forgotten. As every Saturday, the girl sees the boy clearly, a blossom of flame, the spent matchstick spinning out of the shadows and into the sunlight. Even now, as she tries to reassure the couple the tomatoes are fresh, on the vine this morning, on the vine this morning, she repeats. Two thick ropes of smoke begin idly paying out the boy's nostrils, braiding upward in the midday stillness. And then in one movement, she snaps a paper bag open and begins to fill it with tomatoes as the old couple points. This one, this one, this one.
That's a great story and poem. Yeah, I really enjoyed that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So what was that something you observed and decided to write down? How did that one start?
This is one of actually several poems in the collection that I don't know if I would call them homages, but they are they're dedicated to either poets whom I've known well and whose work I really enjoy, mm-hmm. or in the case of there's one poem that's written after Jack Gilbert, or sort of in the style of Jack Gilbert. And one of the things that I wanted to do with this poem specifically was to take an approach to the story that's very much the kind of storytelling or the kind of approach that Louise Glick was taking, especially in her last couple of collections, where the poems take place in sort of a not necessarily obscure but unnamed, like, Mediterranean town,
right.
You know, and the poems sort of center around the personal lives of the people who live in the town, that sort of thing. And so in this, in my little homage to Louise, I decided that it would be nice to cast it in that kind of light.
Yeah.
So that's where the story got took its shape from.
And it's funny, when I was reading about your work in preparation for today's conversation, somebody called it cinemagraphic in nature. I'm trying to remember where I saw that. And I thought this particular poem did a lot of that. And it's interesting because you even mentioned movies,
right?
And the way that the young man puts out his match is like he's seen it in a movie.
Right.
And the other thing that I loved was then, as every Saturday, the girl sees the boy clearly. And it's funny because I feel like there was a time when America would go to the movies every Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked that line, even though it's not referring to the movies. It sort of echoes that whole idea of watching a movie unfold.
Mm-hmm.
Does that seem like it's a stretch? Am I...
No, I don't think that's a stretch.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a stretch at all. But one of the reasons why that phrase, as every Saturday the girl sees the boy clearly, was important is because it points up what I think is so clearly the difference between someone who's dying for another person's attention and someone who sees that person all the time, but they're just not even aware of it.
Yes.
And so that's what I was sort of hoping to get at.
Oh, yeah. And I knew that you weren't referring to the movies when you wrote that. I think that totally comes through. And it's just a lovely story, that one.
Well, I'm glad that you enjoy the poem.
Now, did Louise Glick ever, was she an influence? Was she ever a teacher of yours?
I have been inordinately blessed to have been able to work with just outstanding people.
Yeah.
I mean, from an academic perspective, in my lifetime, I landed pure luck almost at Goddard College in 1970.
Oh, great.
And in the four years that I was at Goddard, between 1970 and 1974, I got to work in workshop situations with Paul Nelson, Barry Goldenson, his wife Lori Goldenson, Louise, who came there to teach. It was the first time actually she had ever taught. And that was, you know, I mean, it's scary to think of, but that's almost 50 years ago.
Right,
but these people have been an incredible influence on me. And
now you have an MFA.
I don't have an MFA.
Oh,
I'm always very careful when I do the biographical stuff, but people just jump to conclusions. I usually, when the bio stuff goes out, it's studied at the MFA, the MFA program. But no, I never actually finished and got the degree.
Oh, okay. Cause actually, that really makes the question even more perhaps interesting, because I was going to ask about your experience of attending an MFA program and if you recommend it to people.
It's an experience that I think anyone could benefit from.
Yeah.
But I'd also, in the same breath, say it's not an experience for everyone, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt incredibly, I mean, even though I didn't get the degree, I felt incredibly lucky and fortunate to. It's really the same thing, but I just was really. I mean, when I was at Warren Wilson, I got to work with Ellen Bryant Voigt, the late Thomas Lux, Heather McHugh, and I mean, these people, each in her own way, so brilliant in their criticism and approach to writing, so incisive and and just useful. I mean, in a kind of a meat and potatoes kind of way.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But at the same time, I have never been my personality doesn't have an academic bent.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that perspective, even though, you know, it was tough for me because of not being able to, I mean, and also going through some personal things this was in the mid 80s
mm-hmm.
that I was at Warren Wilson, and going through a lot of personal uproar and nonsense in my life at the time made it difficult for me sort of to stay on track. But, you know, I'm not going to use that as an excuse. It's also, I'm so distractible that it's possible I wouldn't have been able to stay on track even if I had been, everything had been, you know, hunky-dory.
But it sounds like it was a good experience for you in some craft ways.
It was a tremendously good experience. And it's one, I think, that, you know, that kind of, just being around people like that and people give a lot of lip service to community. But one of the things that I found was really invaluable about that experience was the sense of community that you had, not just with the people in the faculty, but with your fellow students and people who were trying to do this work. And I don't want to tick off the fiction writers or the prose writers, but I think poets in particular, a sense of community, a community can be kind of hard to come by.
Mm-hmm.
And, excuse me, I found it there. And I mean, in such a beautiful and long lasting and formative sort of way.
Yeah.
So I'll always be grateful for that element of that experience. Yeah.
Do you have a support of a community of writers here where you share work with people before you put it out, or?
Not so much with individuals here, but the nice thing about what's happened in the world with electronic communication is that I'm able to keep in touch with people, you know, everywhere, close friends who are also writers. And also just people who are close friends, who are also readers, who are able to give me their reactions and criticisms to pieces and things like that. So from that, you know, in that sense, I mean, I would sort of corroborate what a zillion people have already said about things like electronic and social media, and that's real, you know, if the community is the world now, and, you know, sort of in that respect. So I don't have the pleasure of, like I used to have, of like sitting around in a room, around a table with a bunch of other, like, sort of workshopping stuff.
Right.
Yeah. No, I don't do that anymore. And, but I do have the opportunity, which I certainly, you know, make use of and avail myself of getting those kinds of reactions and criticisms from other readers, you know, wherever they may be.
Right. Now, speaking of reading, I always like to ask my guests if they've read anything recently that they might recommend to listeners, either prose or poetry, whatever.
Sure. Two things. I was able to thank you for letting me read the one prose poem that's in this collection, and I've been reading a lot of prose poetry lately, because it's a form or non-form, whatever you want to call it, but it's a way of writing poetry that's really been calling to me over the last few years. And there's a book that I have been looking at by Franz Wright called Kinder Totenwald, which is a collection of his prose poems. And he really was brilliant in the way that he wrote prose poems. And there's a lot of inspiration to be had there.
Mm-hmm.
Another book that I've been reading lately is listeners may know who Wendell Berry is.
Sure.
He wrote, I guess about 7 or 8 years ago, he published an assessment of the poetry of William Carlos Williams, mm-hmm. Called The Poetry of William Carlos Williams of Rutherford. I would recommend it to anyone who just loves brilliant critical writing that just happens to be focused on the work of, in this case, in Williams, but mainly one particular person. And the thing that I really like about this book is that Barry, Wendell Berry himself, who is not just a great essayist, but also is a poet and fiction writer as well.
Right.
The reason why Williams always was so, and he's very clear about this in his book, he was so attracted to Williams because he thought of himself, he wanted to be, Barry wanted to be a poet of plays.
Uh-huh.
And because he felt so closely connected to his home and farm in Kentucky. And he had come to think of Williams as a poet of plays, mm-hmm. even not of, you know, a sort of idyllic rural, you know, area, but of sort of rough and tumble Paterson, New Jersey, you know, and Williams was a physician, a general practitioner who was really sort of intimately involved in the lives of his neighbors by being a medical doctor. And it's a beautifully written book. And the other thing the other reason I would recommend it is Barry's assessment of Williams is because he gets into he does a fairly close examination of the emotional state that the work of T.S. Eliot worked Williams into.
Oh, wow.
Which is it's really fascinating. So yeah, The Poetry of William Carlos Williams of Rutherford is the name of the book, and okay. Wendell Berry is the author, and I would recommend that one too.
All right, great, yeah. Fantastic. Now, I really would hate to end without you reading the title poem from this collection. Oh, so be it. Do we have?
I would be
do you
happy
mind
to.
Reading that?
Not
to
at
us?
All.
All right, super.
So be it. Some kid's upside-down skateboard, the wheels still spinning. Bordering the marsh, an empty field. No, a red-winged blackbird sways on the highest stalk. I look at the back of my hand, flesh, the veins just beneath, slanted sunlight over a stream in late autumn. Hearing the blackbird's call before he calls. And this hunger, how it goes on, and tomorrow, and always, blazing up in the body, torching the years to ash.
Yeah, thank you. That's it.
Thank you.
I think that's a good one to end on there. I do have one last question.
Yeah.
Well, a couple really, because you're on the show live, so I'm going to ask you about the prompt. But before then, do you have advice for poets, maybe beginner poets?
Advice for beginner poets. Every time I'm asked that question, I come up with some variant of the same answer, which is read everything you can get your hands on.
Yeah.
I mean, especially and not necessarily even. Don't just confine yourself to reading poetry, but read everything that you can get your hands on.
Okay.
That's the way, and then write.
Yeah,
read and write. Those are the two things that are most important to anybody who's really interested in starting out, trying to get their thoughts in the best order with the best words.
And then, as they approach their blank page this week, do you have any possible writing prompt that you might suggest?
Yeah, sure. It's funny. Prompts can be like ridiculously broad, or they can be like OCD specific. You know, like you can say, okay, write 20 lines of blank verse. You know, just like unrhymed iambic pentameter. Or you could say write 20 lines of blank verse that represents one half of a telephone conversation between two spouses fighting about money. So, but I was going to say, here's an easy one that actually I came across in a book of writing prompts, which I thought was a really good one. And that's just write a poem about something or someone you lost.
Mm. Okay. All right, great.
Okay.
So this has been a conversation with the Vermont poet Ralph Culver during April, which is National Poetry Month. Ralph, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me
Shayla,
today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. And in the first hour of today's show, you heard a conversation with Vermont poet Ralph Culver, whose new chapbook is called So Be It. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And you can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. Before I close out today, I'm going to just share the Write the Book prompt I had come up with in case Ralph didn't have one. Ralph did, of course, have a couple of nice ones for us. And all of these will be on the podcast site. But I was really struck by his poem, Fill Up, in which he includes the observation of a debased, this is a quote, debased reflection in the chrome plate of an ashtray mounted damaged at the center of his parents' car seat. And so that reflection allows the poem to take unexpected turns that sort of distort both the narrative perspective and sort of literal distortion. And so I thought in your work this week, you could try to include reflection in your poetry or prose, see how it might affect the way someone sees him or herself or their surroundings. So anyway, that prompt and also two by Ralph Culver will be on the website when the podcast goes up. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. That's it for today's show. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.